This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Would you believe that spirits told Abraham Lincoln to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, or that Ronald Reagan was influenced by the position of the stars? Well, if you're skeptical now, you might be a believer after reading Mitch Horowitz's book, Occult America: The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. The book shows how things that we consider to be mainstream, like the modern self-help movement, for instance, owe a lot to the occult. Mitch is editor-in-chief of Tarcher imprint of Penguin Books. He's in town at the invitation of the Rhine Research Center. Going to give a talk tonight at the Stedman Auditorium on the Duke Center for Living campus. Mitch Horowitz, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I felt that the American occult was represented a story that had really never been told. There has always been an alternative spiritual tradition in this country. It not only goes back to the time of Abraham Lincoln, but goes back to the colonial days of the nation. America has always been a safe harbor for people with alternative religious beliefs. And I felt that some of those folks who brought those beliefs here, they were much more substantial than carnival performers or, you know, parlor mesmerists. There was something about their lives that was worth defending. So I try to chronicle some of them in the book.
And give us a sense of what you mean by occult.
Well, the occult was a term that came into the English language during the Renaissance. It's from Latin, from the term occulta, meaning secret or hidden. It was a term that Renaissance scholars gave to the spirituality of the ancient world, Greece, Rome, Egypt. These things had vanished in modernity, but they started to bubble back up to the surface during the Renaissance. They involved talking to spirits or angels, divination, alchemy, astrology. The Renaissance mind was fascinated with this kind of spirituality that no longer belonged to any church or temple or priesthood. They called it a cult. It had no sinister connotation at all. It just was a reference to a hidden, misunderstood spirituality that had vanished and was reentering modern life.
Well, and that's a key point, I think, the fact that it didn't belong to any particular church, because all churches have spirituality where you talk to spirits, you talk to the dead, you talk to an unseen God. We call it prayer.
Right.
So how is that distinguished from the occult or some of the spiritual movements?
That's right, because many of these things can be found within mainstream religions. For example, you know, New Agers use the term channeling. Within the Catholic Church, there's a similar phenomena that's called locutions. The difference is this: occult or mystical spirituality occurs outside of any established church or congregation or doctrine. You know, sometimes to some people that gives it a sinister connotation, but that, historically speaking, is not how the practitioners themselves understood it. It's a spirituality from the ancient world whose priesthoods and temples disappeared by the time the Renaissance began to spread throughout Europe. And it has remained a kind of churchless spirituality outside of the wall of any particular church or dogma, but some of these practices, including things like astrology, can be located within the mainstream religions. You know, Kabbalah and ancient Judaism accommodates itself to astrology. It gets called a cult when it's practiced sort of on its own.
Right. So give us an idea of some of those early movements in America that have found their way into more modern practice.
Well, one that a lot of people have heard of involves the movement called the Shakers. The Shakers were a group called the Shaking Quakers that existed in England, particularly in the city of Manchester. And in the 1770s, they found themselves under a lot of persecution in Manchester. Their founder, a woman named Mother Ann Lee, had a vision that if she relocated her flock to the New World, they'd be able to thrive here. She came to New York City in 1775, eventually founded a colony in upstate New York in 1776. And as it turns out, she was right. People began to flock to their movement, which was a very radical form of Christianity that also involved things that today we would call seances, mediumship, divination, talking to spirits. The Shakers created all these beautiful things, paintings, songs, furniture. They referred to these things as spirit gifts. They felt they were channeling them from the divine. So Shakerism, for example, was a kind of experimental religion with very strong occult overtones that for a period of time really thrived in America.
Now, we have those, and I guess central New York State for a while became ground zero for some of these movements and the leaders of these movements.
Absolutely. In the first decades of the early 1900s, central New York State was known as the burned-over district. It was considered burned over by the fires of religious passion. And there was a little strip of land in between Albany in the east and Buffalo in the west that gave birth to an incredible range of alternative religious and social movements. Mormonism was born there. Seventh-day Adventism was born there. Spiritualism, or talk talking to the dead was born there. Mental healing was popular there. It was also the birthplace of the women's rights movements. A lot of these alternative movements, both religious and social, trafficked together. They created a kind of opening for people who had been shut out of the culture in other respects. It was really quite amazing. In probably the first four decades of the 1800s, Central New York State gave birth. It was the Mount Sinai of American mysticism. It gave birth to everything that was avant-garde in our religion and our politics.
Yeah, and just so that you don't, or that I understand clearly, because if you think about the women's rights movement, not necessarily occult or mystical, but you're saying that alternative movements got started there, among them these various spiritual and occult movements.
Yes. Well, they actually grew together. They grew like branches out of the same tree. For example, the movement called spiritualism grew up in this country in the late 1840s. It involved seances and talking to the dead and people going into medium trances. Most mediums at that time, and this is probably still true today, were women. So women who wanted to have a voice in the religious and civic culture started to flock into this movement called spiritualism.
Because they were shut out of mainstream religion.
They were shut out. A woman could be a school teacher, she could be an actress, she could be a homemaker. There were no other professions that were open. Suddenly, trance mediums were popping up like mushrooms all over upstate New York, starting in the winter of 1848. A few months after the spiritualist movement began, about 60 miles down the road, this was Route 20 in upstate New York, there grew the first women's rights conference in Seneca Falls, New York. These things were happening in the same neighborhood, and they were happening for the same reasons. Women who had ambitions to be heard in the religious and civic culture were attracted to spiritualism, and that helped to ignite an organized movement that later became known as suffragism.
What was it about this corridor in New York State that bred such this diversity?
I've often wondered that. If you look at population flows in this country, you'll see where all the new religious ideas are going to come from. Central New York State had been home to the Iroquois Nation before the War of Independence. The Iroquois sided with the British during the war, and that gave the colonial government the pretext that it wanted to push them off that land. That land in central New York was open to settlement right after the War of Independence. A vast wave of relatively liberal New Englanders streamed into that area. They left behind their communities, their towns, their churches, and they were ripe for new ideas. And the new ideas just sprang up.
A lot of anecdotes in your book. I'm talking to Mitch Horowitz, who is the author of Occult America. And one of the anecdotes, surprising, about Frederick Douglass,
yeah,
who is also in your book. Tell us about him.
We have been reading the memoirs of Frederick Douglass in this country for generations, and with good reason. But one thing that a lot of readers and historians skip past is a kind of magical episode that Douglass writes about in his youth. When he was a very young man, he was basically the slave and prisoner to a very brutal farmer who he one day stood up to. And this is sort of the famous liberation narrative in Douglass's life. He realized that even though he was a slave in physical form, he could be free in spirit. The one thing that historians tend to skip past in that account is that Douglass writes very explicitly in his memoirs of being handed a magic root, as he called it, before he sort of came to this inner liberation, this state of inner emancipation. He was referencing an African-American religious occult tradition called hoodoo, hoodoo with an H. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it gets confused with voodoo, but it was its own thing. It involved using roots and soaps and perfumes and animal parts, different household items to try to recreate some of the religious traditions of Africa. And Douglass was never quite a believer in this system called hoodoo, but he respected it. And he felt, and it's very clearly reflected in all of his memoirs, that it gave him a certain confidence that day to stand up to this cruel slaveholder. Douglass refers to it as a religious system for which he had no name. The name was hoodoo. And if you look, and I try to trace this very carefully in the book, you can see that the herbs and the spells and the episodes that Douglass talk about come right out of that tradition.
Now, these are things, isolated episodes, stories that people tell. They firmly believe that this is what happened to them. But you also talk about movements that grew out of a cult. For instance, the self-help movement in America today.
Absolutely. The positive thinking movement has occult roots. It really grew out of a movement that sprang up in New England in the 1830s and 1840s that came to be called the mental healing movement. There were a variety of American mystics and religious figures, some people who had broken away from the Methodist Church, some people who were experimenting with what was then called mesmerism, what we today call hypnotism, and they came to believe that the mind could affect the body, that if a person was in a state of disease, their mind might be the key to curing that. This mental cure movement, or mental healing movement as it came to be known, branched off in two directions. One became the religion of Christian Science. The other became what we sometimes call the prosperity gospel, the idea that you can use your mind not only for physical well-being, but to attract money, happiness, material goods. This swept the country by the late 19th century, and this whole idea of the mind as a causative force came to be known as the power of positive thinking. And it is everywhere, not only within the self-help culture, but you find it within evangelical churches. Pat Robertson, for example, talks about the law of reciprocity. That is his rewiring of something called the law of attraction, which was an occult concept that grew up out of the burned-over district in the 1850s.
You have this movement that's growing, perhaps in response, and I've seen a fair amount of literature that suggests that it's in response to also the age and the growth of scientific approach and reason having displaced spirituality. And reasonable people began to worry that something was going out of the culture. We see the Theosophical Society, but also Transcendentalism. All these movements, intellectual movements, are tethered somehow to some trying to keep a grasp on spirituality. Are those two movements part of what you're talking about, Transcendentalism and the Theosophical Society?
Yes. I mean, they're related. You know, through Transcendentalism, Americans for the very first time heard of terms like karma or concepts like reincarnation. They heard of Hinduism, Buddhism, ideas that were completely foreign to the American mind in the 1830s, 1840s. And I think one of America's great innovations and one of its contributions to the spirituality of the world was the idea that you could experiment with radical concepts, radical notions, like the law of attraction or karma or participating in seances, but you could also keep yourself tethered to the responsibilities and the needs of day-to-day life. You see this pattern again and again in American life. The burned-over district is a perfect example where people would engage in prophecy and divination and all these kinds of things that were very far out and remain so, and yet they maintain their farms, their businesses, they built towns, they built communities. America has always been a place where you can experiment religiously but remain grounded in the firm day-to-day responsibilities of life.
So there was more of this going on in the United States than in Europe?
Yes, there was. You know, in Europe, some of these policies, some of these ideas had fallen into ill repute. Mesmerism, or what we call hypnotism, was an idea that got popular in Paris in the 1780s, 1790s. With the advent of the French Revolution, those ideas were swept away. People were not interested anymore. These things had to travel to America to grow and breathe. Americans started experimenting with hypnotism or mesmerism. Out of that grew medium trances, grew the idea of seance circles, eventually grew the mental healing and the positive thinking movement. These things all came to America, and they branched out into many different directions.
Talk about some of the other interesting stories. Abraham Lincoln, a story that he may have received spirit advice about the Emancipation Proclamation.
That's right. There have always been stories about seances in the Lincoln White House, and I've researched it as carefully as a person can, and I think some of those stories are true. Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, was a committed spiritualist. She went through terrible agony in life, losing children, and after her husband's assassination, she turned to the spiritualist movement with great rigor. But she was interested in this while she was in the White House, and she was very forthright about it. And she probably convinced Abe Lincoln to invite a spirit medium one night to the White House during the Civil War era. This was written about in the Boston Gazette. Lincoln permitted a reporter to actually be present and record this. There was another seance, which is less well verified, but was written about in a spirit medium's account in the 1890s. She claimed that she gave a seance sitting for Lincoln where the spirits encouraged him to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. And it's tempting to roll one's eyes at that and say, yeah, tell me another. But the fact is, the spiritualist movement was a progressive political movement as well as being a radical religious movement. Its ties to the women's suffragist movement were very strong. Its ties to the abolitionist and other progressive movements were very strong. Spiritualist newspapers sprang up across this country in the dozens in the 1850s. Not only were these papers abolitionist, but they were liberal in a surprising number of ways. For example, a spiritualist newspaper in Chicago just after the Civil War urged the Lincoln government not to use capital punishment on leaders of the Confederacy. That was the maiden editorial in their founding issue. There was a tremendous humanitarian voice coming up through some of these movements. So when spirit medians said, you know, I was behind the Emancipation Proclamation from the beginning. They're not just blowing smoke. They were present at some of these movements, the progressive political movement in this country and radical religious movements really grew up together.
Was that a sense then because of this connection to the spiritual was also tethered to a kind of moral sensibility? Then?
There was a moral sensibility that actually put forward an idea that today is very popular and in the 19th century it was quite radical, and that was the basic equality of all faiths. Mm. That was an idea you heard again and again coming out of theosophy, transcendentalism, the spiritualist movement, this notion that my neighbor's faith, it may differ from mine, but civically it is equal, it is of equal historical value.
Many roads, one mountain, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So now you talk about Ronald Reagan too. We know there's lots of stories about astrology in the White House.
Oh, yeah. And that is no joke. You know, what people sometimes misunderstand is that Reagan spent 30 years of his adult life in Hollywood. He was a man of Hollywood. He was proud of being part of that community, not only as an actor, but he was part of its religious and social traditions too. He spoke freely about astrology, about UFOs, about psychical dreams, about out-of-body experiences. These weren't weird or distant or woo-woo things to him. These were things him and his neighbors were involved in. You know, Ronald Reagan actually spoke very forthrightly at different times of his life about his interest not only in psychical experiences, but in astrology. One of his closest friends was a man named Carol Reiter, who's largely forgotten today, but he was at one time considered the dean of American astrology. He was on the cover of Time magazine in 1969, the first and last time an astrologer has ever been on the cover of Time magazine. He and Reagan were pals. This wasn't something to be embarrassed about or ashamed of. This was part of Reagan's life.
There is a North Carolinian, Timothy Drew.
Yes.
Tell us about Timothy Drew.
Yeah. Timothy Drew was a North Carolinian who was born just after the Civil War, African-American man who claimed he was raised by a tribe of Cherokee Indians. He later moved to the city of Newark, New Jersey, and he founded an early black nationalist movement called the Moorish Science Temple, which he later moved to Chicago. The Moorish Science Temple was essentially a mystery religion, a kind of melange of theosophical, new thought, early new age, and occult ideas that he thought could become a kind of esoteric mystery religion that could unite black people in America and around the world. He styled himself a Muslim. He wore a fez. He used symbols like the scimitar and the star and crescent. But his religion had almost nothing to do with Islam. He was just aware of Islam as kind of an Eastern faith, and he associated it with the ancient mysteries. His ideas basically formed the DNA of black nationalist movements that were later popular in America, movements that sprang out of the ideas of Marcus Garvey, the Nation of Islam. And he published Timothy Drew, who took the name Noble Drew Ali, published a kind of mystery book, which he called the Circle 7 Quran. It wasn't the Quran at all. It was an early New Age book called the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ, which was a book that had actually been written by a Civil War chaplain named Levy Dowling. It maintained that Christ was a great cross-cultural teacher who united the ideas of all the different religions of the world, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, and what later came to be known as Christianity. So Christ sort of assumed this proportion in the mind of people with occult and mystical beliefs throughout much of this country of being a teacher who could universalize and unite all religions.
Do you come at this as a disinterested journalist or historian, or do you have some ideas about this yourself, some beliefs?
That's a wonderful question. You know, it's impossible to come at this with complete disinterest. People either developed contempt for the subject matter or they develop affection for it. I've developed affection for it. I really do believe that these occult religious movements, whether the Moorish Science Temple or spiritualism or theosophy, they have been vessels for a very important and very true and very affecting spiritual dispensation in the modern world. They should be treated as part of our normal religious history.
Mitch, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Mitch Horowitz is editor-in-chief of Tarcher imprint of Penguin Books and the author of the book Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. He's in town at the invitation of the Rhines Research Center. He's going to speak tonight, 7:30 to 9, at the Stedman Auditorium at Duke, at the Duke Center for Living. That's the campus of the Duke Center for Living. 7:30 to 9, the Stedman Center, Rhine Research Center. You can go to rhine.org. Rhine is spelled R-H-I-N-E. Just ahead, live music from students and teachers of Kid Notes. Stay tuned.